Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here. We have two bills that we are going to be taking up today. The first is going to be a continuation of Senate Bill 1531. This is the bill that we had before us. I believe it was on Tuesday. And we had three individuals that were not able to testify because we just ran out of time. So the plan was to allow them to come forward today if they still wanted to give testimony. So Michael, Scott, and Patrick, if the three of you are here. And Patrick, seeing I don't see, maybe he'll be here.
He mentioned that he might submit written testimony.
Okay. So there's a possibility, based on what Whitney was told, that he may be appearing by written testimony. So, Michael, Scott, who'd like to start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We represent line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state of Oregon. I'm here today to express our opposition to Senate Bill 1531, but I also want to say that I have met with Senator Frederick a couple of times on this issue, and for the record, our organization recognizes this is coming from a place of concern about the wellness of our officers, and we do appreciate the goals that he's getting at. We just we're not in agreement at this point on how to get there. So I don't want anyone to think that this is somehow indicative of a split between our elected officials and our law enforcement community. I think there's a lot of overlap here in terms of what we're trying to get at and what the senator and the sponsors of this legislation are trying to get at, and that is the wellness of our public servants. And that's a goal that we can firmly get behind. I was going to talk extensively about the type of employee assistance programs and peer-to-peer counseling that is already being done in many areas around the state, but I think on Tuesday, Chief Ferreras actually covered that very well, so I'll refer back to his testimony and save us all a few minutes. But briefly, we do like the idea that there could be additional resources for officers that feel that they need resources, and resources for any public employee. We don't believe that there is a need to continue a stigma around mental health services, but we feel that targeting it specifically towards one group of public employees may have that effect. So I've seen some ideas put on the table in terms of improving the legislation. I think that we're actually getting to a point where perhaps some further discussion might find us signing on to some version. I saw that there were some amendments that had been kicked around. I'd like to see us go in the direction of expanding EAP programs. I'd like to see us go in the direction of expanding this to more than simply law enforcement officers. I think that, as we heard Tuesday, it would be well suited to a lot of first responders and corrections employees. And I'd like to clarify that anything that we're looking at, in our view, needs to be an independent, confidential session. We're not looking to this as some kind of a fitness exam that's going to go into somebody's record, because again, our goal here is to look at ways that we can improve and engage on officer wellness. When you have a process that is not confidential, that's not going to get, I think, to the point we're trying to get to in terms of a constructive wellness session. So bottom line here, I don't think that we're at a point where we can support the bill as it is right now, but I do have faith that there is enough overlap to the point where we're going to be able to look at some version of this that we can get behind.
Thank you. Scott.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I submitted some testimony on the fiscal impacts of the bill. We conservatively estimate that the bill would cost all law enforcement agencies, not just cities, system-wide, about $1.345 million a biennium. That's a conservative estimate. We derive that number by looking at claims data and the billed rate for psychologist services. Psychologists were the most common type of mental health professional that we found that people were moving towards. I would note that the psychologists and practitioners who specialize in caring for first responder mental health tend to charge at a higher rate. I believe the most popular one charges at $387 an hour. And point out that the way this bill is crafted, we would pay the full billed rate as opposed to the preferred provider in-network rate, as it's not really a health insurance claim. Additionally, some rural agencies would be impacted differently because of the availability of appropriate mental health care providers, so they would be. We would also add the federal per diem rate of about $98 for lodging, and I believe it's $58 for meals and incidental per incidents where it was necessary for an officer to travel to receive the care. We also have a couple questions in the bill. We're not sure how we would resolve issues where an officer had simply didn't wish to or didn't want to attend a session. I don't know that that's covered in the bill, and I'm not sure we could make somebody go, but some clarity on that matter would be helpful. Moving forward, I also think that there are some impacts in the bill that would trigger interim bargaining in some cases, as this would be an employment requirement. So that is a possibility, not in all situations, but I suspect in some.
All right. Any questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Senator Frederick, I was not able to give you extra time on Tuesday. Did you want to make any other statements? Sure.
And thank you for inviting me up. I'm Senator Lou Frederick, District 22 North and Northeast Portland. What has been really helpful is the number of conversations I've had with both law enforcement officers as well as psychologists. And I think we may have another route in terms of potentially paying for any sort of conversations and discussions. That's one thing we're working on right now. We have two amendments that have already been developed. We have another two that we may be working on as well to define mental health professionals, to deal with some of the confidentiality issues, as well as the cost of having folks do those situations. And I am hoping that we'll be able to work together on that. I also want to thank the law enforcement folks, understanding that we really want to make sure that they are getting the support that they need, and they do not get that right now, in my view. But we are trying to get the support that they need on a number of levels. So I appreciate this, and you'll be seeing a number of other things coming your way very shortly. Thank you.
Any questions for the senator?
Thank you.
Lou, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 1531. And what we're going to do is we're going to open up a public hearing on 1543. I think, let me go ahead and do that so we can kind of have a little discussion here. 1543 is a omnibus bill that relating to public safety. What we have done is we've taken multiple items, issues that have been brought forward during the interim period for us to have consideration. So there's multiple sections to the bill that have nothing to do with each other. They're just within one bill because of the limitations that we have in the number of bills that can be filed and also the need to have these measures come forward. This is a bill that myself and Vice Chair Thatcher have authorized to go forward at this point. We will be, just to give everyone a game plan, we will be meeting after we take the public testimony to decide as to what will move forward. In the sense of taking care of the business on 1543 for the public hearing, what we have done is asked individuals to sign up for the different sections of the bill that they want to testify to. So some individuals will, in fact, need to be coming back and forth to the podium of the dais for their testimony on each of the different sections. And I think what I would like to probably do, and I hadn't cleared this with my chief of staff here, is maybe on giving the summary of each section as we do each section. That way it's a little bit more tied to the testimony instead of having a summary given to the whole bill now and then having the pieces. So for those who are here for giving testimony on 1543, what I'm going to do is go through the different issue sections that we have so everyone knows what's coming, and we'll just take the testimony as it's recorded. I will be asking at the end of each of the sections if someone has not signed up, so they will have that opportunity to give testimony at the same time, so it'll be synced with everyone else. So with that, why don't we go ahead and we'll start off with the intervention program. So what I'm going to do is ask Whitney to please just give us the overview on that particular section of Senate Bill 1543.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1543, as mentioned, is a large bill with a few different sections. The first section of the bill, Section 1, the introduced bill, specifies membership in the Batterers Intervention Program's Advisory Committee and requires the Batterer Intervention Program standards apply to all genders. There is a Dash 12 amendment on OLIS that pertains to the Batterer Intervention Program and makes some modifications to program requirements and advisory committee members.
All right, I have three individuals that are signed up: Steve Berger, Eric Mankowski, excuse me, and Patricia Walford. One of the three, all three of you, please come forward since we have three seats. And while they're assembling, is there anyone else that did not sign up for this section that did want to give testimony on intervention, on the intervention program? All right, so Steve, I'm just going to let you start off since I called your name first.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Committee on Judiciary, my name is Steve Berger, and I'm providing testimony in support of the Dash 12 amendments on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. I'm also a member of the Batterer Intervention Advisory Committee for the Attorney General. Our interest is in relation to the advisory committee membership and the application of current BIP standards to all genders. The current OAR relating to BIP standards are not prescriptive in outlining the number of members, professions, disciplines, or areas of expertise represented, other than to note the Attorney General shall appoint an advisory committee comprised of representatives from the local supervisory authority, batter intervention programs, and victim prevention programs, and other members the Attorney General deems appropriate. Our association supports the Dash 12 language expanding the current membership with equal representation, opposed to the initial change proposed identifying one specific criterion as a psychologist or a psychiatrist. The Dash 12 language inserts language that the Attorney General appoint an advisory committee composed of membership experienced with evidence-based practices relating to risk, need, and responsivity specific to reducing recidivism, and that represent the diverse groups that interact with violence prevention and batter intervention programs. Specific to the application of current BIP standards to all genders, OACCD does not believe a one-size-fits-all approach in the proposed application of current standards. While our association supports in general that DV services be available to all people of all genders, it is important to note that the current OAR relating to BIP standards does not address all forms of domestic violence and battering behavior. Current BIP standards outlined in OAR are sex segregated and not inclusive to all who perpetrate DV. The current definition of a batterer is an adult male 18 years of age or older who engages in battering against women, or a minor male criminally convicted as an adult of conduct against women that constitutes battering in whole or in part. The current standards also state that a victim means a female, including a past or present partner subjected to battering. A victim may be under the age of 18, and in no event shall the batterer be considered a victim for purposes of these rules. These outdated definitions need to be amended in order to provide services be appropriate for people of all genders. OACCD supports the Dash 12 language directing the advisory committee to develop separate standards for programs that address male defendants, female defendants, defendants offending against same-sex victims, and circumstances in which the defendant or victim is gender nonconforming. Further, the standards be based on scientific research and direct practice with both persons who have perpetrated and persons who have survived domestic violence. Our association looks forward to continuing our collaborative participation with the Attorney General's BIP Advisory Committee and the Department of Justice in determining the next steps relating to the BIP standards and advisory committee membership. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Eric?
Thank you for receiving my testimony today, Chair and Committee. I want to begin by describing who I am. I'm a professor of psychology at Portland State University, associate chair of that department. I've been doing research on batter intervention programs for about 20 years now, as well as publishing research in that area. I am co-chair of the Batter Intervention Program Advisory Committee to the Attorney General here in Oregon, and I serve on the Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team. So based on that background, I'm here to give some input regarding the requirement of a psychologist or psychiatrist on the AC. I believe that this is unnecessary and unusual. Instead, a broad range of membership should be recommended.
Eric, I wasn't listening close. Could you just put your full name on the record, please?
Yes, Eric Mankowski.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm a psychologist myself and believe that our expertise is adequately represented on the advisory committee. Currently, there are two psychologists on the committee. There's always been at least one on that committee. And I'm concerned that the language about elevating psychologists and psychiatrists uniquely would create a perception of unequal status or authority on the AC and detract from our effective functioning. Expertise from a wide range of judges, community corrections, victim advocates, batter program staff, and researchers are all needed. With one of these perspectives uniquely elevated, it would distort the balance of expertise and authority on the AC. We have managed to reduce intimate partner violence over the last 20 years in our society by working together in a coordinated community response that brings together expertise from a wide variety of backgrounds. So I support language recommending that we continue to draw from that wide diversity of perspectives. Furthermore, none of the advisory committees in any state in the U.S., based on my research nationally, requires or elevates one group, psychologists or psychiatrists in particular, in this manner. So this language is very unique. The Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team, for example, has a similar kind of diverse membership as the AC and recommends that that diversity be retained. Turning to the language around the application of standards for different genders and different offender groups, currently Oregon standards are written for male offenders against female abuse victims. Adding recommendations or standards for programs for female offenders and those in same-sex relationships would generally be appropriate, I believe. In fact, the AC has been working for years in consultation with national experts to develop language that would be recommendations for female aggressors. And we have a report that we'd be happy to share around that. We concluded in our research that legal standards for programs for women offenders are premature, however, at this point, because there is an inadequate knowledge about what comprises an actual effective program for women's abusive behavior. Furthermore, there are few, if any, programs right now in Oregon for this bill to legislate that address female battering. Generally, standards should be distinct for programs from different genders and sexualities because there's differences in the prevalence, types, forms, motivations, and impacts of abuse across diverse genders and sexualities in our relationships. I can be briefly give you a couple of examples. The idea that violence is used to prove manhood is different when you're thinking about women proving womanhood through violence. It doesn't map in that same way. We know less about same-sex intimate partner violence than we do about heterosexual relationships. And so in all of these cases, there are differences in the forms and impacts. Men's violence is much more prevalent. Sexual coercion is more prevalent. And so we need standards that are distinct and unique and not applying the same language to all genders and sexualities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Patricia.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Patricia Warford. I'm an Oregon licensed psychologist specializing in clinical and forensic work. I first looked at research on domestic violence in 1988 as an undergraduate. I began working with female victims of domestic violence in 1992. I added work with sexually abused children, boys and girls, in 1993. I completed my doctoral dissertation on female victims of domestic violence and my doctorate in 1996. I have been a member of the Yamhill County Domestic Violence Task Force since its inception in the mid-1990s, except for a brief period when I worked outside the county. I've been licensed since 1998. I began doing forensic work in 1999, including with court-mandated domestically violent men for 15 years, which began in 2003. I have been an Oregon certified forensic evaluator since the program began in 2012. I'm recognized in state and federal courts as an expert on domestic violence. My forensic work has predominantly been involved with domestic violence, including criminal cases. I have evaluated almost 24 murder cases and DHS cases, civil cases. I've done critical incident debriefing pro bono for local law enforcement in my community, including those involving domestic violence murders and or murder suicides. I've worked for first responders in addressing trauma. Briefly off, I think the $300, 80, 87, whatever it was immoral, but I will go back to my testimony, thank you. I've worked with first responders in assessing trauma. I was a member of the Governor's Council of Domestic Violence and currently serve on the Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team. My only possible conflict in this interest here is that I'm interested in doing research with John and Julie Gottman and Julia Babcock of the University of Houston. However, I have no financial gain in testifying here today or in a change in the ORSs or the OARs. I have submitted a compendium of articles, 28 to be exact, to support my testimony for today. First, I would like to voice my support for gender inclusive language because the current OARs, you know what, I'm going to take up enough time just because, again, it's disrespectful to not consider the experience of LGBT. And it's important to have gender inclusive language that fits all categories. All right. Next, I want to discuss the importance of having empirically supported research. As I know, the language today is evidence-based. However, evidence-based, you can take a project in one area and can take it to another area and say, I've got some evidence because it was back here. And empirically supported means that I've tested it on this population and it's valid for this population. The Oregon OARs, a battery intervention program, is based on the Duluth belief model developed by Ellen Pence, and as such limits options for treatment of men convicted as batterers. Ms. Pence postulated that patriarchal beliefs form the basis of domestic violence. The current interventions to remediate consist of classes that challenge the beliefs of a male batterer. As no one believes that hitting is okay, the unspoken part of this OAR is that the beliefs alluded to are those that are often held by conservatives, such as the man is the head of the house, or the belief in gender-specific roles, and or the belief that women should be submissive to their husbands. Now, these are not beliefs I hold. However, I don't think that legislating them is appropriate. Research does not support that these beliefs lead to domestic violence any more than the absence of these beliefs results in the absence of domestic violence. Ms. Pence eventually came to reject this position herself when she wrote in 1999, by determining that the need or desire for power was the more motivating force behind battering, we created a conceptual framework that, in fact, did not fit the lived experience of many of the men and women we were working with. Ms. Pence later continued, speaking for myself, I found that many of the men I interviewed did not seem to articulate a desire for power over their partner. Although I relentlessly took every opportunity to point out to men in the groups that they were so motivated and merely in denial. The fact that few men ever articulated such a desire went unnoticed by me and many of my coworkers. Oh, darn, sorry. Eventually, we realized that we were finding what we had already predetermined to find, close quote. This is not science. In 2004, Dr. Julia Babcock conducted a meta-analysis of the use of research as a foundation, for prescribing treatment post-adjudication and found that the Duluth or belief model had minimal improvement compared to probation only. Those who were on probation only had a 40% recidivism rate. Those who went through the belief model training had a 35% recidivism rate. That 5% is statistically insignificant. These caveats were all publicly available before the OARs were written. As I said, I have submitted a summary of the research. Researchers have desired to do research in Oregon, which could have led to evidence-based intervention, but they were thwarted by the current philosophically-based OARs and the gatekeepers who wrote those OARs. Despite this, a few research projects have shown evidence-based that can be empirically supported. For example, the University of Iowa conducted a research project using ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, and had better outcomes than Duluth model based on interventions and with fewer sessions. They had 24 sessions. Subsequently, Zarling, the author of the study, conducted an evaluation of 3,696 men arrested for domestic violence assault in Iowa who were court-mandated to treatment from 2011 to 2013. This analysis showed that the participants in the ACT had half the recidivism rate for domestic violence and two-thirds less violent charges than those who have participated in the treatment-as-usual combination of the Duluth belief model and CBT. In addition, ACT participants who were rearrested had significantly lower charges than those in treatment as usual. The results held for both people who completed the programs and for those who dropped out. More problematic in my mind is that the philosophically based OARs prohibit interventions in which a plethora of research shows activities that do cause aggression. For example, the Oregon OARs prohibit attributing domestic violence to substance abuse, and yet there's considerable research which shows that methamphetamines does cause someone to be aggressive. OARs prohibit attributing domestic violence to mental health issues. This means that the returning vet who, as part of PTSD, has a blackout or a flashback and lashes out will be required to go to classes which change his beliefs. Or the man with bipolar who acts aggressively during a manic or psychotic phase is required to take classes which will change his beliefs. By this logic, your colleague should be very happy with you because you can probably shut down most of the state hospital as if family violence only requires a change of belief classes. This would be irresponsible and ineffective. The research has brought us an understanding
of— Dr. Warfer, I'm going to need you to summarize the rest of your testimony because we have about four more groups.
Adverse childhood experiences studies have shown us that the past experience does play a role lifelong, and yet the current OARs prohibit us doing the past, looking at the past. Finally, an ethical concern is that men and women have been required since 2004 by Corrections and DHS to pay for their own participation in mandated courses which have been indefensible in the research and in practice since 2004. It is well past time for these rules to be changed. Thank you for your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator, that's a couple.
Potentially for staff, one, have you submitted this testimony for OLIS? And I don't see the compendium online.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, but.
I will, sir, I will. It got modified like at 11:30 last night, but I will certainly do that for you.
Yeah, we just want to put on the record because you'd stated that you had sent some stuff in. There's, I think you said like 28 studies support. None of that's on OLIS. Nothing's been submitted to us, so nothing's posted yet. So if you'd like to have that be part of the official record,
I will.
We'll need to do
I certainly will get that to you. Like I said, I modified it at 11:30.
That's perfect. I looked online, and I didn't see the compendium that you created, and I'd love to see it.
Any other questions or comments for this panel? Thank you all very, very much for coming forward. So our next section is going to be dealing with the PSRB. And so first I'll have Whitney give us an overview. And right now I have Sid Moore and Mickey, I believe it's Logan, if I'm reading the last name correct.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. The sections dealing with the Psychiatric Review Board are in sections 4 and 5 of the bill. It requires healthcare service providers to provide the Psychiatric Review Board with medical records pertaining to persons within the jurisdiction of the board upon request, and also modifies procedures for returning a person to the state hospital for violation of a conditional release or change in mental health. Thank you.
All right, so Sid and Mickey, if you're here, please come forward. Bob? Yeah. So is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on the PSRB section that did not get signed up?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, this is the Section 4 in the actual bill. It's not changed by one of the many amendments, just so I'm following the right language.
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski, Senator Gelser, member of the committees. It's Section 4 deals with the release of records to the Psychiatric Review Board, and Section 5 deals with returning persons to custody that have been on conditional release. And presently, there are no amendments. I think there might be a discussion about a possible amendment in the future.
I just wanted to make sure I was following the right document or listening.
We're doing air traffic control today.
Yeah.
All right. So, Sid, did you want to start off, or Mickey?
I would be happy to.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. My name is Sid Moore. I am the interim executive director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. To speak first about the sharing of records portion of the bill. Even at this point, under existing law, the Oregon State Hospital has not automatically shared its records for with the PSRB, but we would like to see this bill pass so that they will be required in the future to do that, and it gives them added protection with respect to healthcare records laws. So our patients who are at OSH are still our patients, and in order to conduct fair hearings for them concerning their mental health, concerning their freedom, the board needs to have all of the records that pertain to that patient, and this section of the bill would allow that, and indeed compel the hospital to share those records with the PSRB. So we ask that you pass the bill with that portion intact. Chair Przanski, should I move on to the transport piece, or would you rather hear from the
transport piece? If it's within the sections 4 or 5 of the
bill. It does.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Regarding transport. Of the roughly 510 patients currently under PSRB jurisdiction, about 70% of them are on conditional release within the community. Occasionally, we do have a patient abscond from supervision. In order to get them back, we have a revocation process, a revocation of conditional release process that works in a certain way during business hours, but most staff at the PSRB are not available after business hours, and so the process for returning someone from abscondent status at that point involves an order from the board or from the executive director of the PSRB. But periodically what happens is that law enforcement encounters an absconded patient as a result of a routine traffic stop, for example, wherein our patient was not driving and so has not appeared to violate any laws aside from violating conditional release. And in those cases, oftentimes no one is brought into custody, and certainly not the patient. The problem with that is that the person has already violated the terms of their conditional release, and we the PSRB have issued an order in that situation to have us that patient returned. Unless the patient has committed a new crime, however, oftentimes law enforcement does not transport them. In those situations, sometimes when the patient is let go, unfortunately, they will go off and commit another crime, which does them no good and obviously does the public no good. So we wanted to clarify, this portion of the bill clarifies for law enforcement their ability to and indeed their obligation to transport our patients back to Oregon State Hospital or to their appropriate placement should they be encountered in the community while on abscondent status. And so we would urge you to again pass the bill with this portion intact to help the person recover in their mental health and to protect the public. So thank you. I'll accept any questions if you
like. Thank you. Mickey?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. I'm Mickey Logan. I am the Legal Affairs Director at the Oregon State Hospital, and I'm here to testify regarding Section 5 of Senate Bill 1543. I should say that the State Hospital is fine with Section 4 of Senate. It's not an issue for us. We support that. Which the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon State Hospital, speaking now to Section 5, will support with an amendment. We're not opposing it right now, but we think an amendment would clarify some things. The bill as written contains language stating that the supervising entity for this revocation process is currently defined in the bill you have in front of you as the board, the chairperson, executive director of the board, meaning the PSRB, or the community mental health program director. We propose that particular language be amended so that the supervising entity would mean the board, the chairperson or executive director of the board, and supervising entity would only include the community mental health program director when the person on conditional release has absconded. Without this amendment, the bill's current language could result in PSRB clients being returned to the hospital by the community mental health program without going through the PSRB. As you might imagine, the PSRB frequently responds to situations where the community wants to send a person back to the hospital. And we're talking about times when they haven't absconded. Maybe the group homes just had enough. And the PSRB has always done an excellent job determining when its clients actually do need to be returned to the hospital and when their clients' needs could be met in other ways. And so I guess another way to put this is PSRB is really good at pushing back to the community and really having that conversation about, is this something that really must result in this person being revoked to the hospital? Or is it a situation where, you know, let's face it, the PSRB clients, many of them are high needs clients and can test folks in lots of ways. So we want the amendment so that the PSRB would continue to be able to serve as the gatekeeper, which is appropriate because it has jurisdiction over these clients. We do understand that these amendments are designed to make it easier for an order to be issued if a patient absconds, and that's why our recommended language would allow a community mental health program director to issue an order if the patient absconds.
So. Great. All right. And Bob.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff from Disability Rights Oregon. First of all, I'd like to say that we support the intent of these provisions to allow people to be taken into custody if they've absconded from their jurisdiction in order to remain safe and to be keep the community safe. We think that the language as it's written is overly broad in certain ways, and we would like to be able to sit down and try to figure out a way to narrow it so that it achieves its goal. I'll just quickly set forth the concerns that we have. The first the same as Mickey Logan just indicated, is that while there's a breadth of people who can order that a person be taken into custody, making the decision about placement is really the unique role of the PSRB. That's what they're there for. We think that's a role that they should maintain. Secondly, the present subsection C says that that a person can be held in jail for, quote, as long as necessary. Particularly when we get out into rural areas where transportation can be difficult, there are no bounds in terms of what necessary means. I'd just like to bring your attention to ORS 426-150, and what that is a provision that prohibits holding people who are being held for a mental health commitment procedure, prohibits holding them in jail, and except under very specific circumstances when that person poses a danger to a care facility to be holding them. And even then, if a person's held in jail under those circumstances, the jail is mandated by law to provide an attendant for that person so that they can be kept safe. Now, these are people with serious and persistent mental illness. There are no bounds whatsoever as in this bill as written, and we
think that that provision needs to be looked at more carefully. The last part is that the bill would also give protection from liability to a law enforcement officer who takes a person into, quote, lawful custody. Now, we're just not sure why that's necessary, since this would be the law officer taking a person into lawful custody. But we work on behalf of people with mental illness who are held in facilities in which there are unsafe conditions, like we're concerned about. And the potential claims that that person has are really constitutional claims that cannot be waived, or protection cannot be provided in state law for a constitutional claim. And that can also include the use of unnecessary force in taking into custody, as well as incarceration. So I think that that provision also creates some confusion. And we're very happy to work with SID and the PSRB to come up with some language that could address these concerns. And we think we can, because we do support the intent of the provisions.
All right. Questions for anyone on the panel? I will just make one statement regarding this portion on the transport. We had a situation which, unfortunately, was a very grave situation out of Springfield, where an individual was, in fact, had an order to be taken into custody. There was miscommunication or understanding on the part of the Springfield police. They chose to just give him a notice that he needed to turn himself in. Unfortunately, he committed a very serious crime after getting this notice. And so for public safety, this is one of the things that we wanted to ensure that we can communicate to all what the responsibility is, and ensuring safeguarding an individual as well. But that's one of those situations that unfortunately became very tragic for the people in that community. So with that, thank you all very much. And
thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and shift to, I think we'll go to the inmate transitional funds.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. This is not in the introduced bill. It is in the Dash 1 amendment. If you recall, in 2017, legislation was enacted creating an inmate transitional fund, and the Dash 1 amendment would prohibit garnishment actions for these funds while they're in the possession of the Department of Corrections.
All right, thank you. Elizabeth, why don't you come forward? Aaron, I have you down as well. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on this portion of the inmate transitional funds? Liz, I'm going to let you start.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Craig with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1543. As you just heard, these amendments stem from Senate Bill 844, which was passed in 2017. You may recall that this was the result of the Inmate Financial Accountability Work Group, and that bill will allow DOC to collect a certain portion of inmate monies for two reasons. One, to go towards their court-ordered financial obligations, such as victims' restitution, compensatory fines and fees, court fines and fees, etc. And secondly, to establish a transitional fund, or a reentry savings fund, essentially to give those who are going to be transitioning back into the community a small fund that they can use for transitional purposes, such as housing, clothes, food, the types of things that they're going to need when they get back out. It was the intent of the work group, and I believe the intent of the bill, to protect that transitional fund, that reentry savings account, from any type of collection or garnishment, and that was not included in the bill. So the Dash 1 amendments will fix that issue, and we urge your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Aaron.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Justice, and I served on the task force that ultimately created 844. And I want to affirm that this was absolutely a negotiated provision in the work of that task force. We had a very hard job in balancing the competing interests of crime victims, civil claimants, and the realities of needing our inmates to enter transition with some money in their pocket. I mean, if you transition out of custody without a dime, you're going to have a hard time. So this is absolutely something we contemplated as being included, and I join with the Department of Corrections in urging the adoption of the Dash Ones.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the Senator?
Yeah, thanks, Senator Brzezinski. I very much welcome this amendment. And, you know, I'm wondering what is it that triggered it? Have there been instances already of attempted garnishment, or this is out of caution?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dembro, the intent was that if we set up a system whereby we were going to be allowing those in our custody to start paying off some of their debts, that we also wanted them to have this option of the transition fund. And we haven't necessarily had that type of instance as you suggest, but we just wanted to be able to protect it. And just upon review of the bill, we realized we missed that portion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, is there an emergency clause on this? And it would be great if we could protect inmates as soon as possible from that.
At this point, I don't think the bill has one.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dembro, the operative date of the bill was July 1, 2018, so we actually aren't effectively in practice yet. We're still working out the system issues at DOC and with our partners at OJD.
So basically, you prefer having enough time to transition into that?
Yes, correct. We're not ready to go live yet.
Great. All right. Any other questions? All right. Aaron, why don't you stay there? Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Shannon Savelle to come up. We're going to next take up the issue on safe kits.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. This is in Section 2 of the bill. It broadly addresses sexual assault forensic evidence kits. If you recall, in 2016, Melissa's law was passed that addressed retaining safe kits for up to or at least 60 years. So Section 2 makes a conforming amendment around that within a statute dealing with providing funds or reimbursement for when safe kits are done. And then it also requires the Department of Justice to create information materials pertaining to what costs are covered by the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund. And this is actually, I believe, Sections 2 and 3.
All right. I'm not sure who wants to go first, take the lead on this one.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, again, Aaron Knott here on behalf of the Department of Justice. This provision, as outlined by counsel, does two separate things. First of all, it puts in what I believe to be conforming amendments on an existing standard, clarifying that the results of sexual assault forensic evidence kits need to be retained for no less than 60 years and any related evidence for 6 months. The interest of the Department of Justice in this provision is in the latter requirement that the department shall create and make available to medical assessment providers informational materials regarding the services available for payout by a fund that we host. We are mostly here to tell you that we already distribute those materials. We think it's a good idea. We support it. We've placed an example up on OLIS that we think is directly responsive to this. We can incorporate it into existing operational expenses, and we're happy to make it happen.
Thank you. Shannon?
I'm Shannon Savelle. I'm the Director of the Crime Victim Services Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. I don't know if I should just put ditto on the record.
Yeah.
You'll have a document on OLIS in front of you, hopefully. It's a multi-page document. Very briefly, it outlines the services, the cost for the services, what we will reimburse to the hospital. We do that directly. The two sections that are highlighted are the portions that the victim or survivor fills out. They fill that out with the aid of the SANE nurse or the advocate. And then that application is then retained by the hospital and sent directly to us. So the victim or survivor is not responsible for taking any additional steps in order to have their exam paid for. In addition, the department will offer up to 5 sessions of counseling through the SAVE program. Again, they don't have to do anything in order to have those counseling sessions paid for. And then, of course, at that time, what we're hoping is that they will apply for crime victims compensation so that we can then provide them additional counseling through our compensation program.
All right, thank you. Questions for the panel? All right, so Shannon, thank you. Aaron, stay there, please.
Thank you.
And let's see, our next one. Aaron, I'm just going to take up one that I believe you're the only one that wanted to give testimony on. This is conditions of probation. And so, Whitney, if you'll give us that overview. Conditions of probation.
Yes, thank you. This is the dash 7 amendment and is not in the introduced bill. And it makes some amendments following recommendations resulting from a risk and needs assessment as a general condition of probation. I guess I should back up. The amends a statute that governs what are called general conditions of probation, which are almost always imposed when somebody is convicted of an offense and placed on probation. And then the second half of the statute addresses what are called special conditions of probation that a court may impose as a condition of probation if it relates to the needs of the defendant or relates to the crime of conviction. And so this makes a modification to the general conditions of probation by specifying it's currently a requirement to undergo a risk needs assessment, and then this adds the requirement to follow the recommendation of the risk needs assessment.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, again for the record, Aaron Knott, Department of Justice, this year on the dash sevens. The language being shifted in which the department has interest is at page 3, lines 14 through 16. This statutory provision outlines the general conditions of probation that can be imposed by a judge. And basically the distinction being made there is on general conditions of probation, if you have probation, you're going to have standard conditions, general conditions. That's a distinction from special conditions of probation, which are targeted particularly at your criminal conduct. And if you look through what's currently allowed under general conditions of probation, you'll see, for example, that you can be ordered to a substance abuse evaluation, and then you have to follow the recommendations of the evaluator. Similarly, you can be ordered to a mental health evaluation and be asked to follow the conditions of the evaluator. But then you get to risk and needs assessment, and the current language says submit to a risk and needs assessment as directed by the supervising officer, but there's no allowance for actually using whatever recommendations came out. And this was called to my attention. I've been trying to deconstruct some legislative attempt or intent for why that distinction is being drawn. I couldn't find one. As far as I can tell, this is just a technical oversight, and I view it as purely a technical fix. It would just allow judges to do something with these recommendations. And I do want to note that if a defendant didn't like those recommendations, they could challenge it in a probation violation in court. So there's no impact on due process here.
All right. Questions for Aaron on this section? Let me just ask, Aaron, why don't you stay there for a second. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on this section dealing with the conditions of probation? Not seeing anyone. Okay, so we're going to move into
our, let me ask a quick question. In the two other instances you note, following the recommendations of the evaluator is the language in both of those occurrences. In this one, it says follow reasonable recommendations, and I'm curious why in the other cases you just say and follow the recommendations, and in this there's this caveat, follow the reasonable recommendations, and your language choice was?
Yeah, Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, I'm sort of only the messenger on that particular word. That wouldn't have been my recommendation, so I'm going to opine a little bit. I think some of it is just the desire to get this done in the short session. I think also there's a nature with risk and needs assessment that both a mental health evaluation and a drug evaluation are going to be fairly clinical in their ultimate recommendations. They're, you know, do you have a mental health impediment that requires a clinical treatment response? Do you have addiction sufficient to require a clinical response? A risk and needs assessment is, I think, by its nature going to be broader. It's looking at a variety of factors that might contribute to potential criminality. And so the recommendations, I think, could fall along a broader penumbra. So again, opining a bit, but I think that that's the underpinning of why you're seeing reasonability inserted as a standard here. And again, you'll have the recourse of returning to court if you want to as a defendant.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. At this point, we're going to go into our next one, which is going to be drones. And so I have Mary and Kimberly. Why don't y'all two come up? And Whitney, if you'll give us the overview on that section.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. This deals with Section 6 of the introduced bill. And there is also a Dash 10 amendment that addresses it. It modifies the elements and exceptions to the offense of unlawful operation of an unmanned aircraft system or drone. The Dash 10 amendment relates to this section and specifies that the causation requirement between the elements of this offense when it is elevated to a Class B felony. So it's elevated to a Class B felony when the drone is used to fire a bullet or some other projectile and results in serious physical injury, or the drone is modified to act as basically a deadly weapon and results in serious physical injury. And so the Dash 10 amendment provides some clarification on the causation between those elements.
All right. Who'd like to start off?
I will. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Kimberly McCullough here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Just since I know there's a couple of new folks, a little bit of the history of this. We have been working on drone laws in Oregon for quite some time, mostly under the leadership of former Representative Huffman, who convened a really broad work group of folks to work on these issues. And it was, I believe, last year or the year before that we realized that although we had prohibited the use of weaponized drones by law enforcement, we had failed to prohibit the use of weaponized drones by the general public. And that was a big concern because we don't generally want folks essentially firing bullets with drones or modifying them in such a way that they could harm other people or that they're specifically designed to harm other people. So our work group set about trying to figure out how to deal with this issue. There were a lot of discussions about exemptions for some commercial uses or uses by educational institutions. And so we really focused on the exemptions. And unfortunately, the way that the criminal law got written for people who were not using them for commercial purposes, it got a little bit messy. And we realized after the session that it was a little bit unclear. And in particular, there was some behavior that would have qualified both as a misdemeanor and as a felony. And so it was somewhat confusing. So what we decided to do was sit down. The three of us sat down. We sat down with Josh Nasby, I believe, as well, and worked it out and just tried to clarify this really is a technical fix. The policy matches what folks wanted to accomplish the time before, but last session, but just didn't quite do. And so just to quickly explain what it does, if you operate a drone that has been weaponized, so it either is capable of firing a bullet or a projectile, or it's been modified in some other way to harm someone. So I don't know, like maybe a weird way to do that would be to have like a chainsaw attached to a drone, right? So if you fly, I mean, it would be odd, but if you fly one of those, right, and all you do is fly it, then it's a Class A misdemeanor. If you fly a weaponized drone and you fire a bullet, and you don't actually hit somebody, but you fire a bullet with it, that elevates it to a Class C felony, so the lowest range of felony. If you fly a drone, you fire a bullet and you harm someone, or you fly a drone and it's been modified in some other way to harm someone, and you harm someone with that particular type of modification, so I guess the chainsaw hurt somebody. Hopefully that doesn't ever happen. But then that would be a Class B felony, so it raises it up. So it's just tiered by the different types of behavior. And so I think it's very clear. I think we all agree about that, and hopefully you do too.
Right. Who wants to go next?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Aaron Knott here on behalf of DOJ. I sat on this work group as well. Sitting on work groups is a hobby of mine, and this is much like our discussion of Senate Bill 844, where we had a long and deliberative process that we felt built a framework, and then when we went back and looked at the statute, it didn't quite line up with the discussions we'd had. So, like with that proposal, I think we really are just trying to bring into alignment with the discussions we already had. So we support this as well.
Hello, Senator Przanski, members of the committee. It's nice to see all of you. I think this might be the first time that I'm rolling into the Senate Judiciary Committee this week. And hello, Senator Benson, Senator Wagner. So my name is Mary Sophia, and I'm the legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. And really, I'm just up here to say, hi, me too. We did sit down, we did discuss this, when we were looking at the language, we realized that it was in fact messy, that two of the provisions were conflated, and it just needed some tinkering. And so that's what we've accomplished, and OCDLA is in support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Wagner.
Has there ever been a case of someone weaponizing a drone in Oregon and attempting to, or even in the country?
In Oregon.
I would say when you Google anti-drone. There's actually people that are producing shotgun shells, but usually it's because they're trying to shoot drones over their houses. I haven't seen any evidence here in Oregon.
Yeah, Senator Wagner and Chair Przanski, I have not heard of it happening in Oregon, but actually what prompted this was, I think we all saw this YouTube video of some college student in another state who had actually weaponized a drone and was firing bullets with it. They had done some pretty fancy work with it to make sure that the drone continued to be able to fly and wasn't, you know, shot out of the air because of the bullet being shot. And all of us on the work group saw that, and folks got fairly concerned and were like, oh, wait a minute. We need to make sure that it's clear that folks should not do that in Oregon.
All right. Senator Bass?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I don't have to knock myself out figuring it out, the difference between Section 6, mm-hmm. Sub 2A, mm-hmm. B, as compared to Section 6, Sub 2A, CA1.
Senator Bentz, Chair Przanski, the difference is sub B, the Class C felony, is when you fire a bullet, and sub C, it's when you fire a bullet and harm someone.
I'm sorry, sub C.
Sub C, and so it's actually there's an amendment, so it's a little bit odd. So the amendment only deals with sub C, and what it does is it makes it so that either if you fire a bullet and harm someone, or you've weaponized it and harm them with the weaponized
drone. I'm sorry, I don't have the amendment. So as of right now, they look identical to me. So
that's the dash 10.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Chair Przanski, Senator Bentz, I'd recommend in the vanilla version of the bill. I think the distinction is drawn on line 30 of page 6 is the additional requirement causes serious physical injury as defined in ORS 161.015. That provision is absent from sub B between lines 19 and 23.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions, comments? All right. So let me just see. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on this portion of the bill dealing with drones? All right, not, then I'm gonna ask Aaron and Kimberly if you step back. Mary, if you'll stay there, because I have you signed up. And we're gonna go to vacating prostitution convictions.
Chair President.
Wait, 1 second.
Oh, sorry about that.
Sir, well, I wanna get on the record what this section does.
Mm-hmm. Whitney? Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Also in 2017, legislation was enacted allowing a victim of trafficking to vacate a prostitution conviction that was related to the person being a victim of trafficking. The Dash 4 amendment, and this is not in the introduced bill, just the Dash 4 amendment, allows a conviction for a municipal prostitution ordinance to be likewise vacated if it resulted from the person convicted being a victim of trafficking.
Mary. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Mary Sophia. I'm a legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I am here in support of the Dash 4. Pretty much exactly like council said, this was a bill that was passed last session, and I remember participating in the conversations, and the intent of the bill was to make sure that we were addressing all prostitution convictions, and this is truly a technical fix. This was something that was just truly overlooked, and so because it's with the intent of what was contemplated last time, we think it's just a quick, simple fix, and so we are in support. I do want to direct your testimony to written testimony by Alex Bassos from Metropolitan Public Defender. He is second in charge over there at Metro, and he also runs their, I believe, community law clinic that deals with collateral consequences and reentry services, and his testimony is posted for you.
All right, so colleagues, this is basically just going to extend, instead of someone getting a conviction out of a circuit court, would be a state court, to a statute or that would be an ordinance at the city level. The courts that I service are municipal courts, and we do prosecute for depending on which court I'm in, has certain jurisdictions depending on what the cities have done. But this is just really trying to extend to make certain those who got caught up with a conviction out of a municipal court would have the same relief as if they were in a circuit court. So it's just technical, as they said.
Yep, exactly. Thank you.
All right, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on the vacating of prostitution convictions? All right, All right, so at this point, we have two more sections. What I'm going to do is just ask Whitney to put on the record the first on the reduction of Class B drug convictions.
Yes, thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. That is the Dash 13 amendment, which is up on OLIS. It is not in the introduced version of the bill. There is some written testimony also by Alex Bassos, if I said that correctly, up on OLIS. Unfortunately, they weren't able to be there here today. But it permits reduction of a Class B felony possession of a controlled substance conviction to a Class A misdemeanor upon successful completion of probation. If you all might recall, for some background, in 2017, legislation was enacted reducing most, if not all, controlled substance possessions to a misdemeanor and allowing expungement. And so this, I think, is to address perhaps a technical fix in allowing that same reduction to a Class A misdemeanor.
All right. So those who are interested, there is testimony that's online that you can review. Pretty straightforward. Again, this is a continuation, kind of making certain we get all the T's crossed and all the I's dotted that we didn't in the last go around. So with that, then I'm going to go.
I'm sorry, Chair Brzezinski. I've missed that sign up, and I don't know if it's worthwhile for me to go ahead and voice support and answer any questions if there are any questions. And so I'll just put it on the record. Again, Mary Sophia, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. As far as the Dash 13 goes, again, we are in support of this. And just as Ms. Perez outlined, it is it's a technical fix, and it's fixing something that essentially was a gap created by all of the changes in the law. And so I think Mr. Bassos's written testimony very briefly and succinctly explains this is going to be treating similarly situated people similarly, which I think matters a lot. And so you can have a conviction for methamphetamine or some other type of relatively serious drug. Upon successful completion of probation, that person can petition the court to go ahead and reduce that from a felony to a Class A misdemeanor, again, with an eye towards reducing collateral consequence for people who have earned that. This is taking into account other types of drugs that are scheduled differently, but in the eyes of the state, based off of the new law passed this past year, not any more serious. And so mushrooms or other types of drugs that are simply scheduled differently. And so it's a technical fix, and we're in support.
Questions for Mary?
Well, right. Maybe not Mary, but maybe you. What bill did we pass that this is coming in?
The profiling. Really? So I think that the way that, oh, I'm sorry. I just jumped in, didn't I, Whitney?
Yes, that's correct. And I don't know the bill number, Vice Chair Thatcher, off the top of my head. Josh Nasby actually worked that bill, but it was the profiling bill.
Last session,
the 2017 session.
Okay. And it came over late. It started on the House, and we got it from there. All right, so we have one other section in here, and that's dealing with squatting. And so I'm going to ask Whitney to just put on the record what this section does, and I'll have a comment.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. This is in the Dash 3 and Dash 6 amendments. It is not in the introduced version of the bill and addresses what is called swatting, and it is contained within the statute prohibiting false information or initiating a false police report. And it addresses when that false report results in a SWAT team being deployed. And what the amendments do is specify that if those situations occur where the SWAT team is deployed and that deployment results in serious physical injury or death to another person, that there would be a mandatory minimum sentence of 60 days, or in one of the other amendments, a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 days. And that's the difference between the two amendments, is the amount of time.
So just to give those who are not familiar, we actually passed a legislation. We have a statute dealing with swatting now. The swatting that we have currently has a mandatory 10-day sentence. This came to my attention, if you may remember from national news back in the Midwest. I can't remember if it was Nebraska or Kansas. There was an individual that was involved in some type of internet game. And he was playing in this round, and someone, I believe, from California got all upset. And the guy in California called the authorities in whatever state this other person was, made this elaborate story as to everything that was happening that was basically activated a SWAT response. The SWAT team got there, and this gentleman, of course, knew nothing. Nothing had happened. Walked out and unfortunately made the wrong movement when the police were dealing with him, and he ended up getting shot and killed. So this is a situation that after seeing that and knowing that we had already started trying to address this, again, we felt that it was appropriate, or I felt it was appropriate, that we do some tiering based on the type of result. It's one thing to call out a SWAT team and nothing happens. The second thing is if an individual is actually seriously injured or killed, that it seems like the sanction should be a little greater. And so that's what we have and why we have it.
Just a commentary. I knew what this was and understood it. I thought there was a very large swath put in a 30-day or 60-day. That's the only difference between them, including death and serious injury. This seems like a very broad brush, 30 days in the pen. I was thinking there it might be appropriate to delineate in some justifiable manner.
Okay, just for clarification, if a person was convicted of this crime with one of these situations where someone was seriously injured or a person is killed, they wouldn't be going to the pen. They would be in custody at a local level.
My apologies. The wording is incarceration, and it'd be at the county level or city level,
right,
or municipal level. But nevertheless, I was just wondering what the thought process was for that justification.
Well, I guess the process that I had was I wanted to enhance the sanctions over just having a SWAT team respond. And we were putting those together as options to consider. I mean, clearly one of the things that could happen is if we wanted to, I have not read the amendment, so I apologize. The 30 days could apply, you know, we could have that apply to someone that's seriously injured, and then if there's a fatality, have more. But the reality, what we also would recognize is there's going to be other criminal charges that will be filed in those type of situations as well.
Thank you, Chair Prezanski. Just for clarification, it's the dash 3 that has the 30-day and the dash 6 that has the 60-day.
So
So it's up to us to decide which amendment to adopt.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's one of the things, again, with this short session, I said, let's just have a couple of amendments. We can discuss it. So at this point, we're not in a work session. This is scheduled for a possible work session. So if we want to go into a work session just to discuss this part, we can do that now, or we can think about it. And then when we work the bill and we bring everything back, we can go forward. As I mentioned at the very beginning of this hearing, Senator Thatcher and I will be sitting down and going through all the notes and everything that we've heard today, and then make decisions as to what we think should be going forward. So if you want to give more input for us to consider, this would be a great time to do that, and I can put us into a work session for that discussion, or if you just want us to come back with a plan and present it to you later, we can do that.
Mr. Chair, I'm fine with you just coming back with a plan, but I'm wondering, so how does it work when you have a longer sentence? Is it a greater fiscal because the potential burden on the state is going to be higher?
Not in this particular case. This is one that's going to be served at the local level, and so the state itself will not be obligated on the funding for those beds. This would be a cost that would be at the local level, either, as Senator Lithgow said, either the county jail, or if there's a municipal municipal jail, that's where those would be.
I would like to add that this is may up to language, so that this is a maximum 30, right? And that individual could also get matrixed out of a county jail system, correct?
Yeah, I don't think it's a may. It's a must, at
least.
Is
it a must?
Yeah. The threshold we have right now under the current statute is if someone's convicted of swatting, they have to do at least 10 days.
Okay.
And then, so this will be, they will have to do at least 30 or at least 60. And, you know, I think the issue, what we're attempting to do is make certain individuals understand that type of a prank can be deadly, and it's, you know, and we do not want to have that type of interaction. I mean, we put everyone at risk, because, I mean, just deploying a SWAT team to get them there takes effort, and then they're coming in and they're focused on what they believe is the situation, and they're going to try to be responding as quickly as they can because of the seriousness of the allegations that have been put out there. And it just hypes it to the point of where, unfortunately, we now have seen this result in the death of someone. All right, is there any other comments? So let me just do this, since we had a lot of different sections on Senate Bill 1543. For those that are still here, is there anyone that did not have an opportunity to give testimony on any of the sections that wanted to and we just didn't get to you? Not seeing anyone run up and charging here. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1543, and I believe that takes care of our business for today, and we'll be back here tomorrow at 8:15, and we're adjourned.